If you've experienced a loss of motivation, energy, or sex drive, or if you're noticing that you're a little softer around the middle than you used to be, it could be your testosterone levels have dropped. By the time men reach the age of 30, in most cases, their T levels have started to decline, and low T can lead to a loss of muscle mass, depression, lack of energy, and a low sex drive. The good news is now you have your remedy with Test X9. This stuff is the real deal, guys. This formula has 9 clinically proven ingredients to naturally boost your body's own testosterone production. Experience increases in strength, energy, and sex drive, as well as improved mood and well-being. Feedback has been awesome. Guys in their 30s and 40s have reported waking up with the quote-unquote morning wood for the first time since they were teenagers. If you want to take it to the next level, you can maximize your results with the Ultimate Test Stack, which combines the Test X9 with the T-Assist, an estrogen control and liver support blend, and Recovery PM, an amazing sleep aid that has had incredible feedback for helping people to get the best sleep they've ever had without feeling groggy that next day. You'll be amazed with the effect of raising your T levels and improving your sleep will have on your overall performance and well-being. Don't settle for average. Man up at LegacySupps.com. That is LegacySupps.com. And use the promo code Sullivan for an additional 10% off your entire order. That's LegacySupps.com. And use that promo code Sullivan for 10% off your entire order for the best health and workout supplements out there. This is Pro Wrestler approved. Welcome to Taskmaster Talks with Kevin Sullivan. I am your host, J.P. John Paz. This week, we're doing a special best of episodes. Will you be hearing great clips throughout the over 2-year run of Taskmaster Talks? Coming up on 2 years, actually, exactly. So what is going to go on today is we're going to hear from Kevin Sullivan, of course, since this is his show, but also hear a little bit from J.J. Dillon, hear a little bit from Eric Bischoff. We're going to hear some remarks about CM Punk. We're going to hear about Macho Man Randy Savage, Kevin Nash, WCW, Vince McMahon, the WWF, and so much more. So let's send it off to little Taskmaster Talks with Kevin Sullivan.
I think there's a lot of reasons, or a handful of really important reasons. The rest of them are, they're still important, but not as important. I think the two or three critical reasons. Number one is the, you know, Nitro, WCW had been dominating, over-delivering, changed the business. All the stuff that I like to, you know, tear cartilage, patting myself on the back, you know, talking about. And then they got it, the audience got a little used to it. We satisfied them. They were happy with us, but there wasn't a lot new going on. There was a lot of decent going on. There was some very good going on. There was occasionally some excellent going on. But whatever it was, the newness of it, You know, the boats got used to the high tide. Let's put it that way. Whereas over in WWF, things had been going all the way up until late 1997 when Vince McMahon famously came out and said, we're going to listen to the fans and we're going to change the way we're doing things. Well, that was Vince McMahon. Okay, fuck, they kicked my ass. Now I'm going to do what they're doing, only I'm going to do it better. When in late 97, when Vince recognized finally that he had to change the way he was doing things in order to compete with WCW, he didn't delay, he didn't hesitate, he didn't take small incremental steps. He went real fucking big. He went with Tyson and Austin. Tyson at the time was as hot as he probably had ever been, almost. The Stone Cold Steve Austin thing was emerging. When you put that two, when you put those two together, and then you put Steve Austin against the Boss, which was kind of a variation on what we were doing, all of a sudden now in WWE world, that's huge news. That's a massive shift. Just like turning Hogan was a massive shift for WCW in 96. That was a really big shift. When WWE abandoned their teen and preteen, you know, creative psychology and embraced what we were doing in WCW with a more real, more honest, more believable kind of storytelling format, that was huge news to the WWE and huge news in the wrestling world. And a lot of the audience shifted to check it out. I did. I knew when I heard they were going to do it, it was going to kick our ass. Come on, Tyson, Austin, McMahon, come on. And that had a lot to do with it. They took advantage. Well, they didn't take advantage. They strategically revamped their presentation. Yes, it did follow our lead in a lot of ways. Doesn't matter. It worked really big. Well, at the same time, while that was going on, I'll just speak for myself. Kevin will have a completely different perspective of this, and rightfully so. But for me, while that was going on, in the midst of it, towards the middle of 98 now, early part of 98, we've got this AOL Time Warner merger going on. It's creating a ton of internal structural changes that, you know, from the business side of the wrestling business, not the creative side, not the wrestling side, not what happened in a show, but the business of the wrestling business was changing dramatically inside of WCW and became much more difficult to manage. All of these things were happening at the same time. In my case, personally, I will admit to losing a lot of my focus when it came to the shows and my contribution as far as, okay, what's our show? What does it need to be? Where are we at? You know, what's a weakness? What's an idea? Kevin, help me out here. Where are we? How can we do this? There was a lot less of me in that process starting in about 98. And I could see the handwriting on the wall. So I think it was a combination of WWF waking up, dramatically changing their format, taking a massive risk with Mike Tyson, who, by the way, was a convicted rapist. Mm-hmm. And I'm a huge Mike Tyson fan. I'm talking about, let's look at the context of the times. Can you imagine if WWE were to try to do that today? Can you imagine? It would not happen. It would not happen. You might not survive a creative meeting if you were to even bring it up as a suggestion in today's environment. But it worked. It worked back then. So it was a combination of a lot of things.
To take your thought, there was always tension between Dusty and Ric Flair because Rick was from the Carolinas. I mean, that's what launched his career. He became from there one of the greatest, if not the greatest champions of all time. But what would happen is that Dusty, the one thing that they would say about Dusty is that Dusty has to go over every night. And with Flair, he would go to Jimmy Crockett and he would go to Jimmy Crockett and say, oh man, business is good now, but it's short-lived. We're going to die because Dusty's ego is out of control. He's beating me every night. after he beats me a couple of times, what's left? And so I would get with Jimmy Crockett, and I would hear Rick in the locker room on our side, and then I would hear Dusty on the other side too, because I had a good personal relationship with Dusty. So I understood the big picture that we had to have balance. And it was hard for me to go to Dusty and rein him in, just because that's not how our relationship was framed. What I could do was go to Jimmy Crockett and say, Jimmy, and this is not something I would do every week. Excuse me. It's not something I would do every week. It would be maybe once every 6 months that all of a sudden that I'm hearing Flair in our dressing room every night talking about, oh, our business is going to go down the toilet. Dusty's beating us. He's beating us, his ego. And once he beats me, how are we going to get the heat back? So I'm having to listen to that. And then Rick would, kind of say, well, can't you talk to him? And I didn't want to say, yeah, I can, but no, I can't. My relationship was not such the Dusty that I could sit him down so I had to do it in a subtle way to go to Jimmy. And about every 6 months it would happen, maybe a little bit longer sometimes. But I'd say, Jimmy, can I have a couple minutes of your time? And he'd say, yeah, come in, close the door. And the conversation would stay just between him and I. And I would tell him, because I'm in the dressing rooms every night, that I can hear what Flair is saying. I can see what's taking place. And the situation was about to boil over. And business was so good that we needed to figure a way to try and keep balance. And so I would go to Jimmy privately. Jimmy would tell Flair, say, Rick, come on over to the house tonight for dinner. And that was a big deal to Rick, to have Jimmy and Myra have Rick over his house for a dinner. And then he could have a private conversation with Rick. Jimmy also could go in with Dusty, close the door with Dusty, and he knew how to have a conversation with Dusty, that no one else was there. Jimmy was still the boss. He was the guy signing the checks. So Jimmy, in his own way, could kind of address some things with Dusty that nobody else could. And Dusty never knew, the same as Flair never knew, that I was talking to Jimmy, had a great relationship with Jimmy, and then Jimmy would then, he knew what to tell Flair, bring him over to the house, have dinner. Rick would, he'd come to the dressing room and say, oh, last night, he said it was like old times. Jimmy had me come over his house for dinner. And oh, man, and he would be good. And then Jimmy knew how to talk to Dusty too. And, stroke Dusty in the way that he could have. And it was an unbelievable run that we had for a couple of years.
Here's something. I wish I had read Dusty's book before he passed, because JJ and I love Dusty. And you know what he's talking about, how he had to go over there and smooth things out.
Mm-hmm.
You could get on Dusty's bad side, meaning JJ or me, very easily if you approached him and it was like he thought it was a personal affront. It happened to me a lot. It happened to James a lot. He was very sensitive on a lot of issues. And I think the way James would handle things, and that's the other reason, maybe Dusty didn't outwardly know what James was doing for him, but he could tell that somebody was talking. Dusty was no fool. He would figure it out. It was James, because Rick would cool down. I was near that, and that era, and I was in the heel dressing room, and I was hearing that every night, and I would look at James, and he'd be just taking it in. I could see the wheels turning. But he wasn't going to go over and tell Dusty, and I wasn't going to go over and tell Dusty, because James and I had a bond that what we heard stayed with us. And it was the only thing difficult about Dusty was walking around him and walking on eggshells sometimes and keeping him on the right track politically, because there was a bit of a rivalry for years, and I don't mean just a little rivalry, with him and Flair about the belt, about Rick being a great performer, but Dusty being the great mind. And there was, do you feel that, James? There was a little bit of a competition amongst them?
Oh, absolutely.
And Jimmy Crockett probably had to do the same thing with Dusty once in a while, calm his ass down. Yeah. So,
And he could do it because he was signing the checks. I could not go in and say to Dusty what Jimmy would.
And you have to have a guy like James that knows how to bridge personalities. It's so much different now because everybody's on a contract and they know what they're going to get. I mean, guys, back in the day, if you were working with someone and you found out that he got $100 more, there was shit to be paid.
So the next matchup, the Giant, now christened member of the NWO, defeats Macho Man Randy Savage in about 8 minutes or so. What was the thought here of kind of just having NWO be dominant? Giant can't lose if since he just turned heel?
Yeah, and the other thing was, you know what I talked about, the invasion angle? Well, it's still drawing, and it still just had the Giant come over. And everybody's sitting at home saying, oh, they're going to work a double DQ or some kind of bullshit finish, or someone's going to run down. Well, the Giant goes over, and he goes over Randy. What was the exact finish? Do you remember?
Some sort of cheating and then a choke slam, I believe.
Yeah, but we got the choke slam in.
Yeah, yep.
And that was a very important thing. And again, Randy Savage was a complete businessman on this. He understood. He could have balked. You know what I mean? He could have probably went to Hulk and said, hey, listen, this isn't right, blah, blah, blah. But Randy knew what was going to draw money. And, I mean, we had to be, meaning WCW, we had to be Davy Crockett and Travis at the Alamo. You know, we had to be fighting an impossible fight. And Randy stepped up to the plate, and I never have had any qualms with Randy Savage. Randy did some shit that he never should have did for me. One time I was wrestling in Chicago, which is his hometown. You know, his father was a huge star off the TV in Chicago in the early 50s. I mean, his dad was, the U.S. champion when there was only one U.S. champion. Think about that. When all those territories, when those 42 territories, his father was the only U.S. champion because it was coming out of Chicago. And I was putting Randy over it, and he gave me a slam and said, move on my elbow. I'm thinking, what? Yeah, I'm supposed to take the elbow for the finish. He said, no, move. He slammed me, ran up the ropes, and I'm still debating when he's hanging in the air, but I'm thinking, God, he's stiff with this one. I roll out of the ring, roll out of the way, he hits the thing, he said, cover me. I cover him, he held me, 1, 2, 3. I said, why did you do that? You know, he said, I just think in case we can come back, I thought. So Randy knew business, and, you know, he was really unselfish. He really was.
Were you okay with, like, that kind of stuff where, like, the wrestler kind of just says, all right, I'm changing the finish? You're okay with that? If it's Macho Man, I guess you're okay with it?
If it was somebody else changing the finish, if there was a reason, and I understood what Randy's reasoning was with me, he wanted, I knew Randy way back when we used to compete in bodybuilding contests together. And I kind of befriended Randy when he was in those bodybuilding contests. I was in the open contest. He was in the novice contest. And I showed him some stuff. And he did very well. He was a very intense guy. Do you know that he was in the Cincinnati Reds minor league farm system, right, John?
Yep. Yep.
You know, he broke his arm. Are you aware of that?
Yep.
And that every day he threw 10,000 balls with his left hand.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow. Interesting.
He was a catcher. There's no left-handed catchers. And when he broke his arm, he broke his throwing arm, his right arm. He became a first baseman and threw 10,000 balls in a tennis. You know the tennis places where they have the wall where you can whack the ball against the wall and play by yourself?
Yep.
He threw 10,000 balls a day. His father did 6,633 sit-ups. Has the Guinness World Record to this day. Obsessive compulsive. If you look up the dictionary, there's Randy. You know what I mean? No, yep. I wouldn't want guys changing finishes, but hey, if it's Randy Savage that wants to put somebody over, he has a reason to. So, yeah.
Now, as far as kind of the NWO at this point, obviously, Randy will go on next month and he'll main event against Hogan. Does it matter that he lost here and is main eventing next month against Havoc, against Hogan at Havoc for the title?
No. Randy Savage is an icon of the wrestling business. He came to us with something to prove. You know, people don't realize that Vince had put him out to pasture. You remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Made him an announcer, said he was over the hill. Randy was an intense man. And I spent a lot of time with Randy. Later on, I spent a lot of time with Randy because I had a place over there at Indian Rocks Beach. There was actually North Reddington Beach at the time. And Randy didn't live too far away, and we go to the gym together, and we hung together. We go out at night together. Randy was a really, really good man.
He is definitely absolutely underrated. I can't believe WWF at that point, you know, let him go or thought he was done because, my God, he has 5-6 years left of main eventing left in his body at that point. So it's pretty crazy of WWF.
Right, right. I mean, you know, I was talking to Ric Flair lately, and we were laughing. He listened to me, you, and JJ, and he told me he blew boogers when we were talking about the time in Chicago, right?
Yeah, yep.
And Iron getting the phone call when he just got into bed, and we were talking, and I said, Rick, you're still around, and Herd was trying to get rid of you from 1989.
Yep.
89, wanted to get rid of him. You know, that's when I heard brought him in the room and said he was going to be Spartacus. You heard that story, right?
Yeah, horrible. Yep.
I said to Herd, he said, we're going to pierce his ear, cut his hair, and give him a trident. I said, well, we're at this. Why don't we go to Yankee Stadium and change Root's number from 33 to 663. But I mean, you know, we all can't always sit on the nose, but think of Randy was done. That's surprisingly.
Yeah.
For a guy all that money from, you know what I mean? It was one of the greatest, if not the greatest, entrance I've ever seen. And Punk, I've met him one time years and years ago. He was a tag team partner of mine against Dusty in the independent show. He has something. I don't know really what. Maybe it's a generation that was in front of me that I can't connect with. I think I can, but he connects with that audience because he's one of them. And nobody else in the wrestling business would have had the balls after 7 years of not being on TV. The high point for me is when he ran and jumped in and they caught him with open arms.
Yep. It's great.
Bring me back. Take me back. I'm yours. The psychological view for me was he was resurrected. And those fans are his apostles.
Well,
I don't
said,
think
yeah.
this guy can do anything wrong if he's allowed to book his own shit. But that's the only thing I'm afraid of. His fans are the most forgiving fans I've ever seen. In this day and age where people turn on you on a dime, like Goldberg, right, gets booed out of the building.
Yep.
Lashley becomes a babyface and he's the top heel, right?
Yep.
Where he grabbed Goldberg in the front face, locked and looked around. He was a babyface, right?
100%.
Forgiving is he got his ass kicked there in Chicago the first time he fought. The second time he got beat up. Nothing was in their mind about that. Their guy was coming back for them. He did an incredible, incredible job. The best I've ever seen. So when we talk about great workers now, for me, that's the greatest work I've ever seen. So I got to say he's the greatest worker of all times.
Wow. Damn. There's a feud between Ric Flair and Bischoff, which really began on September 14th behind the scenes. Started well before that, but Flair returned that night to reform the Horsemen. The Horsemen, of course, would feud with the NWO, and then really the main feud became Flair and Bischoff, which is very, very interesting. Obviously, we got the Giant DDP mixed in there too, but Flair and Bischoff, I mean, this was real, right? I mean, Flair said, I'm going to go watch my kid do a wrestling tournament. He said, no, you're not. He just did it. Bischoff basically tried to fire him. Flair comes back and says, fire me. I'm already fired. One of the greatest promos ever. One of the greatest pops ever. September 14th, 1998, Nitro. Awesome. From South Carolina. Awesome. But they really didn't like each other, right?
No, they were at that time at each other's throats. And I understood both sides. Now, as time has gone on, if it was the other way around, I'm sure Eric would have went to his kids because they're both big family guys. So, you know, it's hard to tell Ric Flair, you're not going to go. But in your job, you're expecting guys to give up everything. The problem was when he gave other guys days off.
Yep.
And that's not a knock to anybody, but you gotta I know that nothing's fair in life, but that's a hard one for Rick to swallow. And it's hard for Eric to swallow him saying he's not going. So I don't agree with either one of them. I think that there was so much tension there. They could have worked it out. In fact, couldn't they have had a jet for Rick to fly him back to the show? Do you know what I'm saying?
1,000%, yeah. Why wouldn't they? Yeah.
I mean, you know the kid ain't going to be wrestling at 10 o'clock at night. So couldn't they have flown Rick in, and could we have changed it to be early and maybe give it an extra pop and then flown Rick out of there? I think that, you know, most of the times arguments continue and elevate because there's no communication. Everybody wants to win on an argument. That's what's wrong with this country right now. Everybody's right. Nobody wants to listen to the other side. And, you know, it can't be your way all the time.
Eric Bischoff defeats Ric Flair in about 7 minutes. Of course, Kurt Hennig helped him here. He handed Bischoff a weapon. Bischoff nailed Flair with it and pinned him to win the match. What do you think here? Bischoff, not a wrestler, going over the greatest of all time. I know this is a great feud and it's real and the crowd is really into this. And Flair, for whatever reason, is really selling for Bischoff. I mean, he's trying to make him look good. He's bleeding. I mean, he's doing everything he can. But wow, this is a shocking conclusion here because, you know, the GOAT is losing to a non-wrestler.
Usually I'd say this isn't the way to go, but on this one, Eric had so much heat. And I think that Rick would have balked if he didn't realize how much heat Eric had. I think it was the right thing to do. And it had nothing to do with ego on Eric's part. It was the right thing to do.
Man, the amount of heat he got, he may have been the biggest heel in the company at this point. I mean, he was vilely, vilely hated. I mean, he's just a pure heel. It was nuts.
And don't you think that Vince copied Eric?
Yes, I've always thought that, yes.
Yep.
People always go back to when McMahon was doing McMemphis. Remember he was doing a heel in 94-ish that. But I don't know. On the national scale, I mean, he was doing the Bischoff character.
Exactly. Exactly. So I don't have any qualms about Eric going over because he had so much heat.
Did Flair have any problem with Bischoff going over?
Obviously not, for Rick getting all that juice.
It's very interesting, though. Like, they hate each other, but Flair, obviously the super professional that he is like, yeah, it's good business. I'll put the guy over. You know what I mean? And like, right, pretty crazy.
Right. Well, that's how people that love the business and understand what the right thing to do at the right time is.
And the next night on Nitro, they'll have a rematch. Flair cuts this awesome promo, strips naked in the ring, basically. You know, typical Flair. He's going nuts, saying he'll put his career on the line, whatever. He wants a rematch because he was screwed because of Hennig and Bischoff from Starrcade. And they'll have that rematch, and Flair will win with a little bit of an assist from the Macho Man Randy Savage, of all people. So what a pop. I mean, just I remember that Nitro. Bischoff winning was huge heat, and they hated him. But Flair winning the next night at Nitro and getting that pop, and Savage getting the surprise return, and him beating up the Giant. I mean, that was awesome. It's great stuff.
Yeah, it was. It was very good.
And you would think, like, the amount of people that were involved, you think it's Flair Hogan, but it was Flair Bischoff getting this free reaction.
That just goes to show you how much heat Eric had. He did a magnificent job.
I just go back to when Flair said, fire me, I'm already fired. Like, there's nothing you could do to me. I'm Teflon, you know? I don't care who you are, Bischoff. Great stuff.
Yeah, it was. Rick is, that's why he's the GOAT.
pay-per-view buys 255,000. What do you think about that?
Kevin was the booker at the time. I was with him as his assistant or whatever he needed. But we always hear the negatives about Kevin. He did a remarkable job when he took over.
What do you think about him as a booker overall? Do you think like you are, you know, definitely you like to book heat. You like to, you know, get a lot of the bad guys, quote unquote, the heels over. What would you kind of think of Kevin as a booker?
He had the same philosophy. And Kevin knew how to get heat. I heard some people say he didn't have that many moves, right? There's only been one guy selected to the Baseball Hall of Fame unanimously. And that's Rivera, right?
Yep.
He had one pitch.
True.
Yeah.
Kevin. And it's funny, Hogan didn't have a lot of moves either. He's he's one of the best.
Yeah. And Kevin, if he kept the job and he would have grown into it magnificently. Kevin had so many outside ventures at the end. You know, he had movies and other things. So he didn't get fired. He went to them and said, I'm going to take a break and I want Kevin to take over. But if this was Kevin's pay-per-view.
With him as a booker, what is he like relying on you for? Does he want you to kind of set him up, or are you just kind of going over the details after he lays out the show?
Him and I, you know, we became really close because he had me, he had Mike Graham, Bob Mole, and we would be in the office. Actually, Kevin got us out of the office into a hotel so we could get work done. And Kevin would ask me what I thought about things. He would ask Mike Graham for finishes. He surrounded him. Mike Graham was one of the greatest finish men in the business next to his father. So Kevin was smart on people he chose to bring in. And Kevin was very, very well liked in the dressing room backstage, especially the Hispanic boys love Kevin. Kevin is a cool dude, a great guy to have. I told you this before, you can talk art to Kevin, you can talk sports to Kevin, you can talk wine, you know. I can't talk it on his level, but he's just an all-around cowboy.
With him and him being so close to the boys, does that make it weird, like for the booker? I know you said you kind of like a player's coach yourself, but is that weird to be that close to the boys and be a booker?
For some people, it is very difficult. But for Kevin, first of all, Kevin's when he walks in the room, you know he's somebody. Kevin has this magnetic personality. And he got a lot out of guys because everybody wanted to work for Kevin because he made them feel good. I can remember when guys become under the curtain. And like Rey Mysterio, he walked by and Hoovy, he'd pat, give them both a pat like you do in football in the ass. And thumbs up, guys. He appreciated the guys' performances. He was very diplomatic in giving out finishes. If it was ever questioned, I gave a finish. I said, this is what Kevin wants if you want to talk to him. he's in his room. Go ahead. And 90% of them would say, well, okay, that's fine. And if they did go in there, it was just to tweak something. Maybe they want a little more time. And other than that, I never saw any problems that he had backstage.
Do you think he was a little intimidating, maybe, to some of the boys? I mean, he's a massive guy. Known as one of the toughest and strongest guys in the business, too. So was he intimidating, you think, at all?
Oh, I used to train with Kevin. And at my strongest, I squatted 800 pounds. Kevin was doing back work on Nautilus equipment with 750. I've never seen anybody come close to that. I could maybe do, and I'm talking about in my best, he was getting 405 is four plates. He would get 15 reps. I may get seven with 315. He was really an imposing guy. And he never came across as a bully when he became the boss. And I think that had a lot to say about Kevin's character. I know some people think that maybe he held people down, but he really didn't, because it goes back to explain, like they're probably doing right now, the WWE, explain why you're paying that guy so much money and they're not working that much. It's not in their contract. Well, because there's other guys that are better. And Kevin would try, when I say better, better paychecks. Kevin would explain it to them in the coldest and truest fact. Hey, I get a report why I'm doing this. And if I do it too often, my neck is on the line too. You're not going to lose your job. I can't remember anybody that was let go by Kevin unless their contract ran out and their contract negotiations failed.
What do you think were like his credentials to become a booker? What did he do as far as, I know, obviously be a world champion and be great athlete and everything, but what kind of made him want to be a booker, or made Bischoff and yourself think he could be the booker?
Kevin had great ideas. They tried to kill Kevin off when he first got there, whether it was intentional or not intentional. I happen to have my own thoughts on it. I'll keep them to myself. But they gave him Vinny Vegas, right? And yep. They had Diamond Dallas Page, who hadn't found himself yet, be his mouthpiece. Then they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on that backdrop for the disaster of Oz. They took a 7-foot guy who had just won Mr. Georgia, made his hair gray, put a cone on his head, and had me walk to the ring with a wizard mask on. And Janie Ingalls as Dorothy. I mean, Kevin had to dig himself out of a hole. And the other thing was, Kevin got to stand and watch outside the ring some of the greatest performers in the history of our business. He got to see Sean every night. He got to see Scott up close working with Sean. He got to see Austin. He got to see them all from ringside. And Kevin absorbed everything. Kevin absorbed everything. And he had such a personality. Everybody wanted to have a beer with Kevin. And he had his statement, it's true. Guys wanted to be like Kevin and girls wanted to be with Kevin. So Kevin had it, but he overcame a lot of bad shit that I don't think I've ever seen anybody dig himself out of that kind of hole in my life.
But Ron, the infamous Plan B with Bob Roop and Boris Malenko and Ronnie Garvin and Cowboy Bob Orton. I mean, this is a shocking, shocking thing that went down. But, you know, please tell us a little bit about Plan B.
Plan B is in 1979, I had a wrestling war. I brought in Bob Roop to book for me. And I didn't know Bob's history. If I had, I probably wouldn't have put him in that position. But a couple of years earlier, he had tried to take away Roy Shire's territory, try to get control of Roy Shire's territory out there in San Francisco. And he came into my territory. I was back and forth. I was just building Southeastern in Pensacola. I just bought it. So I was spending a lot of time in the South. And I was depending on Bob to take care of business in the North. And Bob got, you know, he got to where he... I think he thought that he was being cheated money wise, and I didn't have a reputation for cheating guys money wise. It was never a deal. Nobody ever had a problem with it until Bob Roop came along, you know. And I think he was trying to convince some guys that hey, we're not getting paid properly, and so end up turning into a war. And as the war went on. Obviously, we ran in the Coliseum. They ran on the next night in Chihuahua Park in the outside amphitheater. And their business wasn't good. Our business wasn't as good nearly as it was before, which is traditionally happens in wrestling wars. Both people suffer. And anyway, they toward the end of this time, probably in 6 months, I sold out. I basically sold out to Jim Barnett. Out of Georgia, and they decided that they were going to do this video, that they were going to, I don't know if what their plan was, but they called the video Plan B, and all I can think is they were planning on maybe taking this video and circulating it around the territories, and maybe, you know, threatening the promoters and blackmailing them into money maybe, you know, hey, we're going to send this into your territory, get it on your TV, and then, or either you pay us and we won't come in, or I don't know what their plan was, but when I first saw it, I never saw that video for 30 years. And wow. I had a guy, and I was doing, about to do a Super Stud cast on my Knoxville War, and the guy sent me something on Facebook. He says, Ron, have you ever seen what's called Plan B video? And I said, no, what are you talking about? And he sent me that video. Well, you can imagine, Kev, what I did. I mean, watching that, like, oh my God, is this for real? I mean, were they really going to do this? You know, so their plan was if they didn't win, they were going to kill Knoxville, obviously. And then they were probably going to utilize that stuff to somehow make money off of other promoters by threatening them.
Yeah, I know of it, John, very well. I saw it just recently, the first time I saw it. But I was approached by Roop to jump, right?
Wow, okay.
I said to him, how am I going to do this to Ronald, who's a friend of mine? But he says, you're not making the money you deserve. I says, last week, I traveled 330 miles, and one of the trips was 220 round trip, right? So that meant the other 5 days, I traveled 110 miles, and I left my boat at 6:30, okay? And I was on the semi-main event. I made $990 back in 1997. The guys, when they opened a match, made $650. I said, explain to me how he's stealing. I said, I'm pretty good with figures, and they're supposed to pay 33 1/3%. Some of these spot shows, he's paying 80%. And he said, oh, no, no, you're going to get screwed. But I'm going to tell you what I think the story is, Ronald. Do you remember they said there's homosexuality involved in it?
Yeah, I think I do remember something that, about John? It.
We're going to talk about the impact of homosexuality on the wrestling business.
Go back and look at it, because he said,
okay.
And the homosexuality, we're going to expose it. You had just sold it to Barnett. They had a meeting, and Barnett bought them out. Barnett paid them. And they that was what their whole plan was, I think, was try to embarrass Jim. I mean, it was common knowledge in the wrestling business, John, that Jim was gay.
Right.
But Jim never fooled with any of the boys. And Jim was, you know, he was a wonderful promoter, too, and a very smart guy. And Ronald worked for him. I worked for him. And I think we both learned a lot about him, because he was very, very smart in the way he did business. If you look at how Ronald did business, it was very similar to how Jim did business. He got incredibly hot heels and got hot angles going and drew money. But I think they were going to try to expose him. And I think he gave them some money, Ronald, because years later, Bob Orton told me he was at a meeting and he put his feet on the desk up in Knoxville. And I'm not sure, but I think when Jim brought Mark Lewin to Atlanta, he was going to have him be the booker in Knoxville. And that only lasted a couple of weeks, and he brought Marky back to Atlanta. And then Knoxville was just used as an occasional spot show.
Yeah, see, I never knew that, but that makes sense.
So for me to be working right there with Taker and Vince McMahon, you know, and everything, I mean, it don't get no better than that.
What was he like back then, you know, as a young guy in the late 80s, early 90s? What was he like? Completely different guy?
Well, no, he was the same guy. He's always been one of the nicest guys in this business, okay? He's always tried to help people. I've watched him come back to TVs and stuff, and before he, you know, has to go out and do whatever he has to do, he'll come out during the day doing rehearsals, and he'll just on his own just step in and try to help guys. Nobody asked him to do anything. He'll just do stuff on his own, and I could always go to him if I had problems with other people. You know, he would always kind of watch my back, and not only me, he would just look out for everybody. So Taker was one of the nicest guys in this business, and I have a lot of respect for him.
Did you ever foresee him being the, you know, one of the biggest stars of all time? Is that impossible to say?
Well, no, that's not impossible to say, because I was with him the day that he left WCW. Him and I both was in the office with Jim Herd. Jim Herd was running the company at that time. And I was in there complaining about I had some problems with Flair. And then Taker would have problems with Ole Anderson. So Ole Anderson didn't want to pay Taker a certain amount of money, is what I gather. You know, I mean, this has been quite a long time. And so Taker told him no, and he left, and Taker went straight on up to WWE. So, you know, just I was right there through it all.
Is it true that... Oh, sure, Kevin.
Go ahead, John. I'll follow you.
I was going to say, is it true Ole that day told him you're never going to make any money in the business?
He told him he'd never draw a dime. He had red hair and freckles or something, he said to him, but he told him he'd never draw a dime.
That's how smart Ole was. In my opinion, and everybody has one, nobody has drawn the money that The Undertaker has for this length of time. Anytime he goes out, he draws. And I don't know anybody else you can say that about. Hogan had a down period. The only other one that comes into my mind, the only other two is maybe Rock and Austin, but I think Austin had a little bit of a downtime when they turned him with McMahon. That was so ridiculous, you know what I mean? That was one of the hottest angle of all time, McMahon and Austin. But the Undertaker, he's like the ever-ready battery rabbit. He just goes and goes and goes. And there's no telling how long he could come two times a year and draw money, because every time now, what I equate is, it's like you're going to watch Mickey Mantle's last game. You know, you don't know if that's going to be the last time you'll see him, and people are going to pay to see him. And all he needs is a little angle, and his mystique is over so much. And for not being able to see that, how tall is he, Teddy? 6'5", 6'6"?
Yeah, I would say somewhere like that.
You know, you can't teach height. You know what I mean? You can't teach physical presence. And I'm not going to, this is an holy bashing, but hey, we all make mistakes, but that was, had to come back to haunt only, I mean, because we're not going to draw.
Kevin, I'll say this to you. I don't think it even come back to haunt Ole. Ole didn't give a shit about nobody, so I don't think he really cared.
Yeah.
But can you be any more like that wrong, though? I mean, obviously he was so completely wrong, it's ridiculous.
He didn't, I guarantee, that didn't bother him one bit. Ole didn't care about, no, I don't know whether he liked himself. He didn't like nobody. So I don't even think that bothered him at one bit.
That's Kevin, what would you? Teddy made a great comment. Did Ole even like himself? I don't know. You're right, Teddy. You're right. I mean, he was the hottest guy.
He didn't like anybody. He and a lot of people, you know, a lot of people thought, you know, him and Flair were really tight. But I come to find out, you know, in the long run, that he didn't even like Flair.
Yeah, yeah.
And Flair's the one got him his job.
I know. Crazy.
Kevin, was he hard to work with as far as booking and stuff?
Oh, he's just so arrogant and so negative. I remember this is 1,000 years ago. I had just won three bodybuilding contests, and I came on TV and squatted 425 pounds 26 times. Now, here's a legitimate contest I won, and I won a powerlifting contest. Ole says, I was ripped. I had like 3% body fat. Ole says, you look too skinny. No one, I can't have guys losing to you. Thinking, whoa, so maybe I should gain 50 pounds and be fat. You know, he just never complimented anybody. The only guy I ever saw him compliment anybody, Stan Hansen. He loves Stan Hansen. Other than that, no. I mean, you know, Tommy Rich drew money. Well, he was okay, but I was the one that made him. No, Tommy made himself. There's another guy that people don't know the history of. Tommy Rich, when we went to Ohio, Michigan, when Georgia Championship Wrestling took over that area, it was like Tommy was Mick Jagger. People were throwing the hotel room keys in the ring. Girls were throwing their underwear in the ring at Tommy. I mean, he was over. And Ole said, well, I built it. No, you didn't, Ole. You gave him the spot, and he made it work. Like Teddy. We gave Teddy the spot, and he made it work. There's plenty of guys. We wouldn't be talking to Teddy today if he didn't take care of his job that he was given and overexceed. You know, so Ole saying, well, this guy, Tommy Rich, never drew. You know, this is ridiculous. And he, you know, the great match, the precursor to the Hell in the Cell was the Battle of Atlanta with Buzz and Tommy. And they turned people away. And Ole said, well, it wasn't that good of a match. What are you, shit me? I mean, if somebody had a video of that, they could probably sell it for $250,000.
Yeah.
You know, and then Ole was so negative, John. I don't know how, you know, Blackjack Mulligan knocked him out three times in 3 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
And I mean, you think you'd learn not to screw with a guy that knocked you out with one punch the first week, but it took only 3 weeks to learn.
This has been a John Paz Power Trip production in conjunction with the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling. You could follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Two Man Power Trip. You could check us out on Facebook. You could subscribe on YouTube. You can go to patreon.com/TMPTEmpire to become a patron. And also check out the website TMPTEmpire.com and buy a shirt at ProWrestlingTees.com. Two Man Power Trip, where the power lies. Brother.